everyone who loves books. This is Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On Air, the show all about books that belongs to you. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week, as you can hear, we're going on to a flight of fancy into the world of science fiction.
I'm Robert Kirkwood, and I'll go multimedia with War of the Worlds.
With slow, deliberate movements, the unconscious body was dragged away, and there was nothing I could do to prevent it.
One of our listeners reintroduces an alien plant species.
The trouble with Triffids, I said, as we poured another drink, is chiefly the things we don't know about them.
One of our narrators reveals his alien voice.
It needed to be stylized and menacing. And then they fed the voice through a synthesizer.
Philip Reeve reveals his vision of a future universe ruled by search engines and crisscrossed by steam engines.
Is this about the necklace? That girl? Is she one of your people? This is not about a necklace. Where is Raven?
And I go back to the source and read the book that inspired the first Blade Runner film. That's all coming up in today's Read On Air.
So kicking off the sci-fi show, let's look at War of the Worlds. Now, Red, what's the first thing that comes to mind when you think of War of the Worlds?
Being terrified and hiding behind the sofa when I was a little boy.
Well, it could be this.
I can see it now. It's a white handkerchief tied to a pole. Flag of truce. If those creatures know what that means, what anything means. Wait a minute, something's happening. A humped shape is rising out of the pit. I can make out a small beam of light against a mirror. What's that? There's a jet of flame springing from the mirror and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames. Now the whole field's caught up by the woods, the barns, the gas tanks of the automobiles spreading everywhere. Coming this way now, about 20 yards to my right.
Ladies and gentlemen, due to circumstances beyond our control, we are unable to continue the broadcast from Grover's Mill. Evidently, there's some difficulty with our field transmission.
That was, of course, the drama by Orson Welles.
Yeah, I first heard that at a very impressionable age.
Or, of course, it could be the book that inspired everything, The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells. Unabridged and available from RNIB, it's read by Robin Holmes.
A thousand such questions struggled together in my mind as I watched that vast sentinel shape. And in the back of my mind was the sense of all the huge unknown and hidden forces Londonward. Had they prepared pitfalls? Were the powder mills at Hounslow ready as a snare? Would the Londoners have the heart and courage to make a greater Moscow of their mighty province of houses?
Which I read under the covers soon after hearing the Orson Welles version.
Or you're possibly aware of one of the two movie versions.
This could be the beginning of the end for the human race. For what men first thought were meteors or the often ridiculed flying saucers are in reality the flaming vanguard of the invasion from Mars.
We welcome you! We're friends! Yeah!
Tell me what you saw.
This car is us.
Get in.
Get out of the truck. I'm not kidding, Ray.
Get in, Manny, or you're gonna die.
Get out!
But I think I'm a bit more familiar with this.
The double album of Jeff Wayne's musical version of War of the Worlds was one of the best-selling albums of all time, and also one of the longest-running. I asked Jeff Wayne what it was about the original H.G. Wells book that inspired a whole rock opera.
Well, it goes back to the mid-1970s, and my dad reminded me at one point in my career that one of my aspirations was to try to find a story or two that I really felt passionate about, and to try to, from a composing and producing point of view, turn it into some form of musical work, whether for record, for live stage, or performance. The first thing was to find the story, and he was right, and we started reading all sorts of books, not particularly just science fiction, and one of them was the H.G. Wells story of the War of the Worlds, and he handed me this book just as I was going out on tour with an artist that I was producing at the time and who had signed to my fledgling label, and we were enjoying a good run together, and he was a terrific artist, David Essex, who's still very much going in his career. And as I was on tour, you get plenty of time, and I started reading this book, and I discovered this amazing Victorian tale that had quite a visionary appeal about it, and the way H.G. Wells saw life through the eyes of Victorian humanity, but with a very futuristic concept of aliens from Mars that had amazing weapons and machines that certainly dominated the Earth, and was a very terrifying read, in fact, when you try to place yourself in Victorian times when all you'd have is maybe rifles and cannons to defend yourselves with. So that's what got me going with it.
Next morning, a crowd gathered on the common, hypnotized by the unscrewing of the cylinder. 2 feet of shining screw projected when, suddenly, the lid fell off. Two luminous, disc-like eyes appeared above the rim. A huge, rounded bulk, larger than a bear, rose up slowly, glistening like wet leather. Its lipless mouth quivered and slavered, and snake-like tentacles writhed as the clumsy body heaved and pulsated.
Now, did the structure of the book, or rather, the two books, to be more accurate, did the structure of the books influence the composing and the final work?
Yeah, well, after I read it, I discovered that H.G. didn't write it as a book. It was written as an episodic adventure for a magazine called Pearson's in 1897, and it was its popularity that then his publishers asked him to novelize it. And he divided it into two books. One was The Coming of the Martians, and book two is The Earth Under the Martians. And it was so well structured, and I think maybe because the chapters were so succinct, probably going straight back to the weekly edition or biweekly edition that Pearson's used to publish his chapters in, and I kept it all very much intact. So the opening chapter to the book is called The Eve of the War, and it reads sort of like an overture in a way of something pending, something that was ominous, was about to happen. So my first composition and sequence is called The Eve of the War, and I wanted a piece of music that grabbed the listener's attention as if something was about to happen without revealing too much.
Would you like some coffee or some tea?
Some coffee would be fine, thank you.
Take it, Richard.
Straight black. Or maybe some sugar in it.
Okay.
At Talking Books, we know the importance of a great voice, and War of the Worlds has one of the best. What was it like working with the narrator, Richard Burton?
Richard, in the mid-1970s, was somebody who had a fair amount of publicity as a hellraiser, so I wasn't sure really how the working relationship was going to work out. But the man that walked through the studio door was probably the most charismatic and prepared professional that I'd ever worked with. He was so totally prepared for his work, and to give you an example, we had a contract with him that allowed us to call on him for 5 studio days, and he did not only what appears on the album, which is about 77 sequences, but at least as much again, and he did it all in one day, and just a bit of repair work for about 3 hours on a second day, and that was it.
With slow, deliberate movements, the unconscious body was dragged away, and there was nothing I could do to prevent it. With slow, deliberate movements, the unconscious body was dragged away, and there was nothing I could do to prevent it. With slow, deliberate movements... I'll do the whole thing again. That's what comes of coffee. With slow, deliberate movements, his unconscious body was dragged away, and there was nothing I could do to prevent it.
He took direction. There were takes that we did that we thought was terrific. He said, no, I can do that better, and he did it better.
While that voice sounded, the solitude,
The desolation had been endurable. By virtue of it, London had still seemed alive, and the sense of life about me had upheld me. I'm sorry, that's a murderous four words. I'll do it again.
So he was quite the opposite of the reputation that preceded him, and I was very privileged to work with him.
A few young men crept closer to the pit. A tall funnel rose, then an invisible ray of heat leapt from man to man, and there was a bright glare as each was instantly turned to fire. Every tree and bush became a mass of flames at the touch of this savage, unearthly heat ray.
And what is it about the H.G. Wells book, written so long ago, that makes it still so popular today?
I think its core themes are very relevant today, just as much as it was in the 1890s when H.G. wrote it. And that, for example, his Martians with their tentacles was really an analogy for the expansionism of nations and the conquest through the use of power. And he felt that if power, even in his own nation's hand, was wrongly used, it was something he wanted to criticize. And we were at the height of the expanding British Empire at that point, and that's what he was taking a pop at, and I sort of like that. I think just look at today's world, and there's as much territorial invasions and conflicts going on in the world today, which has as much sort of analogy to the H.G. Wells story of the 1890s, so I like that, and that's very rich in its textures from a composer's point of view.
Thanks to Robert and to Jeff Wayne. Now that I'm no longer hiding behind the sofa, I can tell you that War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells is available in various formats from the RNIB library, including an abridged version, an unabridged version, and I believe Robert has found another version.
I was so excited when I found this. You can join the actors from Star Trek and Star Trek The Next Generation as they recreate this classic radio thriller from Orson Welles. The pace and details make it clear why the 1938 broadcast of an eyewitness report of an invasion from Mars caused a nationwide panic. The cast are John DeLancey, who played Q in Star Trek The Next Generation, Gates McFadden, who played the Doctor on TNG, and Leonard Nimoy, who played Spock. There's also Armin Shimerman and Brent Spiner among the cast from the LA Theatre Works series.
What will they do to us? I thought it all out. Right now, we're caught as we're wanted. The Martian only has to go a few miles to get a crowd on the run, but they won't keep doing that. They'll begin catching us, systematic-like, keeping the best, and storing us in cages and things. They haven't begun on us yet.
Not begun?
Not begun. All that's happened so far is because we don't have sense enough to keep quiet, bothering them with guns and such stuff, and losing our heads and rushing off in crowds. Now, instead of our rushing around blind, we gotta fix ourselves up. According to the way things are now, cities, nations, civilization, progress.
And if that's so, what is there to live for?
There won't be any more concerts for a million years or so.
War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells is available in many formats from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
And staying with the sci-fi theme, still to come in this week's show, The Voice of the Daleks. And I review the book that inspired Blade Runner. You're listening to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews, and author interviews. And we'll have more after this.
Talking Books.
In the Talking Books Library.
With a frenzied, incoherent cry, the ship's surgeon fled the bridge. Within minutes, the entire ship was altered.
Star Trek, the classic episodes.
The library tapes on Cordrazine said that at such dosages, paranoia was a frequent outcome. But McCoy knew the ship too well. By the time a search was organized, he had reached the transporter room and beamed himself down to the planet the Enterprise was orbiting.
The adaptations of almost every single episode from the original series of Star Trek are available on audio from RNIB Talking Books.
Bones! He shouted.
No! No!
But he was in time only to see McCoy disappear into the cloudy octagonal frame, his body popping out of sight as though it had been swallowed.
There are three volumes mirroring the three seasons of the show. Volume 1 has the episodes from Season 1, including The Naked Time, Shore Leave, The Squire of Lothos, Space Seed, and The City on the Edge of Forever.
What are you? Kirk said.
I am the Guardian of Forever.
Volume 1 is 23 hours 9 minutes long, and it's narrated by William DeVries. Volumes 2 and 3 are read by Hayward Morse. Volume 2 is 25 hours 20 minutes long. Volume 3 is 21 hours 49 minutes long and includes stories such as The Last Gunfight, The Empath, and Spock's Brain.
Damn you, Bones, talk. He was worse than dead. What do you mean? Jim, McCoy spoke pleadingly as though he were appealing for mercy from his own sense of helplessness. Jim, his brain is gone.
Star Trek The Classic Episodes, Volumes 1, 2 and 3 are available from the RNIB Talking Books Library. For more information, head to www.rnib.org.uk/talkingbooks.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Do you have a favourite book that you'd like to review on the show? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share. Drop us a line by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. And that's exactly what listener Chris Gray did. And here he is telling me all about a science fiction classic.
The following day's investigation of the village had shown Triffids about in considerable numbers. The surviving inhabitants were either those who had shut themselves into their houses to exist for as long as they could on what stores they had there, or those who had been lucky enough to encounter no Triffids when they made brief foraging sorties. All who could be found had been collected and brought back to the manor. They were healthy and most of them were strong, but for the present, at any rate, they were more of a burden than a help, for there wasn't one of them that could see.
The book that I'm quite interested in is a book called Day of the Triffids, and it was written by an author called John Wyndham. In a way, I was an unwilling reader because it's one of the books I read when I was at school and I've kind of revisited several times in my life. I guess I found it very interesting because it was about sight loss, because during the course of the book, it very quickly unravels that the main character in the book, a guy called Bill, he hadn't lost his sight, but he had been in the hospital because of a sting from a Triffid. And he is actually a biologist working with these things. Now, they're a sort of walking mobile plant, and along with this there was a sort of they describe it as being a sort of fireworks show in the sky from Comet. Sky grows bright green with bright flashes. And that's how the majority of the population overnight of the whole world, it seems, loses their sight. And the world sort of gets taken over by Triffids, and it's really a question of the Triffid against the blind man, or a few people who seem to have somehow kept their sight.
And it's far more than just a sort of post-apocalyptic horror story, isn't it?
There's an awful lot in the book about morality, should the sighted people help the blind people? There's quite a lot in there about because they've got to somehow kind of rebuild the population. There is within the book a big question about what kind of society can they sustain, because it's a bit like a situation after a kind of nuclear holocaust, I suppose. There are a few survivors who haven't, sort of been infected. And now, should they try and help the sort of blind people or not? Are there the character in the book Coker? And Coker sort of believes that the sighted people left should try and help those blind people that they can. Okay, so he kind of gets an idea together. One-sighted people can help 10 blind people, and, you know, they should sort of form kind of foraging gangs and so on. But somehow, gradually, all the blind people catch some sort of plague-like disease and slowly kind of die off. Quite why or how this happened is unsure. It's suggested that it could be a hygiene thing. It could be something to do with water. It could be waterborne disease, because apparently Coker and Bill had only ever drunk a bottle of beer and that kind of stuff. And there are various other ideas about what kind of society should evolve. Should it be a kind of sort of a totalitarian society with or should you kind of recreate democracy, or should it be some kind of a different model?
We can all judge for ourselves as far as Day of the Triffids is concerned. It's available in various accessible formats from the RNIB library, including as a talking book. Chris Gray, thank you so much for reviewing Day of the Triffids by John Wyndham.
Thanks very much.
But the Triffids are a real factor. They're something that no rising civilization has had to face before. Are they going to take the world off us? Or are we going to be able to stop them?
Thanks, Chris. The Day of the Triffids by John Wyndham is available from the RNIB Library in Braille, giant print, and as TB2181. And it remains a haunting, thought-provoking read. You're listening to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio. Still to come, sentient trains that can crisscross the universe. And do androids dream of electric sheep? But first, the RNIB Talking Books narrators are a versatile lot. They have to be. All those different voices and characters they have to master. But how do they manage it? And what are they doing when they're not locked up in the Talking Books studios? Robert Kirkwood caught up with one of them and found out more.
In the small hours, Sir Alfred Milner, High Commissioner for South Africa and Lieutenant Governor of Cape Colony, was woken by a bright light in his eyes. He had a stateroom on the starboard side of the upper deck. It was 4 a.m., he noted in his diary, the small red diary, which was the only companion and confidant of his travels.
That's David Graham reading The Boer War by Thomas Pakenham, one of many books he's narrated for RNIB, although many listeners may be more familiar with him, sounding like this.
This is the stately home of Lady Penelope Creighton Ward. Parker speaking.
He's very well known for providing many voices for Gerry Anderson, including Parker and Brains in Thunderbirds, and was the co-inventor of the voice of the Daleks. And when he joined me in the Talking Book Studios, I asked him about his latest book.
It's called Lifting the Latch. It's a book narrated by a wonderful chap called Mont Abbott, who spent his whole life on the land in Oxfordshire. And he has total recall. It's about a dying world in a language that's dying out too. In fact, there's a glossary at the end of the book with words that you probably never have heard of. Hmm. But an absolutely wonderful character. Sang in the church choir, a wonderful voice, never made much money, had two terrible accidents in his life which badly affected him, two tragedies, I would say, but indestructible. I admired him so much at the end of the book. He's a hero of mine now.
Now, it sounds like quite a challenging book to do.
It was a very challenging book because I had to work on the accent and the syntax. He had dictated the book to a lady who got it in all order. But he had wonderful memory, almost total recall. It wasn't an easy book to read, but it was well worth the effort that you just have to put into books. You prepare them.
Mm.
A lot of the work goes in preparation, you know, and it's not easy to read books, but it's very rewarding, I find.
How long have you been reading for RNIB now?
Oh, I mean, at least 25, maybe 30 years, I think. I started in the old studios in Great Portland Street when we recorded on tape, which was much, much more laborious than these days in state-of-the-art studios and, you know.
Now, are there any books in that 25 years that really stand out?
Well, I would say this one does for a start, Lifting the Latch. But I've read so many. There was a book on the history of the State of Israel by a famous English Jewish historian.
Mm.
They give me books which have Jewish references because I was born Jewish and, you know, I know quite a lot about it.
Mm.
When I enjoy reading them. But I must have read, I don't know, getting on for hundreds, you know, I don't know how many books I've read. It's difficult to recall particular ones. But I finished the Lifting the Latch and I'm reading this book about, it's a children's book really, very funny and imaginative, about two young kids who come across a weird machine on their travels. So I've just started that as well. Which is, it's a doddle compared with the other book.
Now, some children will know your voice because you're Grandpa Pig in Peppa Pig.
Yes, that's right, and the wise old elf in Ben and Holly. And my voice career goes back a long way, starting with Gerry Anderson. And then I created the original Dalek voices too, with an actor called Peter Hawkins many, many years ago, I think in 1962, Doctor Who. And I also appeared in two of the stories in Vision as an actor.
Yeah, because you go right back to the very beginning almost of Doctor Who. The episode Daleks was in 1963, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And then I did The Gunfighters, which I think was in black and white, with the first Doctor Who, where I played a cowardly barman, and it's become a very well-known one.
Mm.
And then I did another story with Tom Baker, which I played a Russian. It was City of Death, but it was a nice part. I had to age up, so from sort of middle age to old age. So they had to take me out and put me in front of a camera and then do a bit more so that it all came up in a flash, you see.
Yeah. Now, the voice of the Daleks is iconic. How did you actually come up with it?
Well, it was done in the old Lime Grove Studios in Shepherd's Bush. We just played around with it. I did it with a chap called Peter Hawkins, now sadly not alive anymore, an old friend of mine. And he was a marvellous voice man too. He did the Flowerpot Men and all sorts of stuff. We came at it from the approach that it needed to be stylized and menacing.
Hmm.
And then they fed the voice through a synthesizer. So it made it even more menacing and, you know. So it went like something like that. That fouls. You know, that was that sort of stuttery thing.
Hmm.
And it seemed to work because they've gone down in vocal history, haven't they?
Now, you're also very well known for playing both Brains Parker and Gordon Tracy in the Thunderbolts.
Yes.
How did that association with Jenny Anderson come about?
Well, that's a long time ago. It was in the 50s, if you can believe it. I was doing a television film down at Elstree, and in a pretty ropey script, and by one of those lovely accidents of fate, Gerry Anderson happened to be directing, and in between takes, I was playing some villain on the run. He mentioned that he was about to go into animation and puppet voices, cartoon voices, and I pricked up my ears at this. Well, I said, you know, I'm not bad at doing accents and voices, and if you do anything, I'd like to be considered. And about, I don't know, it was about 6 months later, he took my number, and he phoned me, and then I ended up by doing five series for him, beginning with Four Feather Falls, then Supercar, Fireball XL5, Stingray, and the big one, Thunderbirds.
Mm.
So it had a big effect on my career. But of course, parallel to that, I was working in the theatre and in television, and then I was a member of Laurence Olivier's company at the National Theatre before the new building for 2 years, and that was a wonderful experience, and toured with them in Australia in The Front Page, and worked with Laurence Olivier in a play called Saturday, Sunday, Monday, with Franco Zeffirelli, and I did other plays in the West End, Arturo Uy, which is a famous Brecht play, and then two plays with Leonard Rossiter, the great Leonard Rossiter, who played in Arturo Uy, and then in Make and Break, a Michael Frayn play. You know, so, you know, I've kept dotting about from radio to the theatre and television. You know, I've had my ups and downs, all actors do, but I've been lucky. You know, you've got to take your opportunities, and, you know, sometimes you meet the right people, and it has a terrific effect on your career.
You were Big Brother in the 1984 Apple advert. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that was amazing. That was Ridley Scott. I mean, that came out of left field. I mean, I went to see him because I do voiceovers, commercials, but I haven't done many visuals. And I went up, and he said he was casting Big Brother, and they picked me out to do it. And when I arrived at the studio, they gave me a page of script. Well, I said, why didn't you send it to me? I can't learn this. So they wrote it all up. And they dressed me in this sort of, they plastered my hair down, and I wore two pairs of glasses, and I ended up reading it off a crib, you know. You wouldn't notice it, but it became very famous. And they show it every year at the Super Bowl in America, which is a big American football game. And then I cop a few repeats over the years, which has been great. Good luck and cheerio.
There are many books narrated by David Graham in the Talking Books Library, including Lifting the Latch by Sheila Stewart. Available now. For more information, head to www.rnib.org.uk.
Thanks to Robert and to David Graham.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
The RNIB Helpline is your direct line to the support and advice you need. Whatever your inquiry, the RNIB Helpline team are only a call away, with practical and emotional support, so you can face the future with confidence. Our friendly, specially trained operators are just a phone call away, from 8:45 a.m. and to 5:30 p.m. every weekday. We can help with information on everything you need to know about the RNIB, from eye health, advice on how to volunteer, reading services and loads more, or we can simply offer a listening ear. The RNIB Helpline, here for you on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in both Braille and giant print, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
You're listening to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up later, the book that became Blade Runner. But before that, Philip Reeve is at the vanguard of new science fiction. His latest series, Railhead, is set in a futuristic steampunk galaxy connected by sentient trains. It's a vision that I can only describe as Blade Runner meets Thomas the Tank Engine. Here's Philip Reeve to tell us more.
Is this about the necklace? That girl? Is she one of your people? This is not about a necklace. Where is Raven?
Railhead is a fantastic concept. I've given a taste of what it is, but could you tell the audience a little bit more about the background to the book?
Yes, Railhead is set in the far distant future when human beings live on all sorts of different planets scattered all over the galaxy. And the planets are linked by railways, by trains which zip through some kind of hyperspace portal and can take you from one planet to the next. So it's basically a railway-based space opera, and a whole sort of empire has grown up around these the railway stations on the various worlds. And on one of the planets lives a young lad called Zen Starling, who is a sort of a thief and a ne'er-do-well. And early on in the book, he's hired by a character called Raven to steal a particular object from the Emperor's art collection. And of course, it turns out, as such things always do, to be much more dangerous and important than he had imagined. So that's where the story starts.
And it's a book that's full of humour and the joy of ideas and discovery. I love the fact that we have sentient trains travelling faster between universes than spaceships can, and so spaceships have pretty much fallen out of use and people take the train everywhere.
Yes, trains are very very exotic and high-tech, and in this world they don't have drivers. They're intelligent machines, and they kind of look after themselves, and each locomotive has its own personality. And yes, spaceships, of course, are regarded as very kind of run-of-the-mill and not very interesting at all.
I wouldn't call it a dystopian book. I think it's more hopeful than that. Did you set out to write something that wasn't dark and terrible like Blade Runner, but actually was a little bit more akin to, I don't know, the culture novels of Ian M. Banks?
Yes, I didn't really know the culture novels, in fact, until people started saying, oh, Railhead is very like those. So I went and read one. And I guess there are some similarities. My future isn't quite as utopian as that. But I did definitely want to not write a dystopia. I think there have been quite enough dystopias, thank you, in recent years. There's been a bit of a craze for them, and I'm kind of bored with them. And I also found them a bit limiting. I wanted to imagine a world that is more like the real world, in that it has nice bits and nasty bits. And, of course, it's quite important that you have both, because my hero starts off living in a rather grimy, grotty corner of the universe, and he wants to escape from it, and that's kind of what drives the story. That's what motivates him to do the things he does, is to better himself. So I needed some sort of different levels of society like that, but yes, on the whole, I think it's a very nice future. It's a future I'd like to live in. Most people are having a great time.
It definitely feels linked to our present.
Yes, I mean, I think any decent science fiction is really about the present rather than the future. It has to be. It's only going to be of interest if it casts some light on the world we live in.
I was going to ask, I mean, it's a very visual future. I, as a blind person myself, I was struck by how you blink at things that appear on your headset to scroll through menus and to find information. And having tried Google Glass, I found that impossible to use as a blind person. Do you think there's any room for blind people in the future that you've written about?
Well, to be honest, I think medical technology will have advanced to such a point in a society like this that there wouldn't really be any reason for anyone to be blind unless they chose to be. Equally, headset technology I'm talking about, it's kind of transmitting stuff straight into people's optic nerve. So that would presumably be a way around blindness. I'm talking about a world where technology can kind of solve most problems.
And I certainly wouldn't want you to think that I felt it was an exclusive book in any way, because actually I know that you started as an illustrator and a writer, and I felt that you paint wonderful world pictures. I've often wondered how graphic novels could translate into prose, and I could see the engines that you were describing and Cleve B Station. Do you think, having come from an illustration background, that makes you a more descriptive writer?
I don't know. I mean, there are plenty of very descriptive writers who I don't think do come from an illustration background or an art background, but it's certainly always been the case for me. My two loves when I was growing up were, you know, pictures and stories, and I like to combine the two. And I did become an illustrator, but it was much more a sort of cartoony style of illustration that I was doing. I wouldn't really have been capable of drawing a picture of the kind of things I'm describing in Railhead.
And the second book in the series, Dark Light Express, is just out as a commercial audiobook. Railhead is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB23956. Just go to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. And we'll be hearing more from Philip later in the show. Have you found a hidden gem in the library? Or maybe you've got a book that you think would expand my reading horizons? Drop us a line by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. I always love a recommendation that fills a gap in my book knowledge. And this week's Educating Red did just that. It's a sci-fi classic that I thought I knew all about from its film adaptation. Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep by Philip K. Dick was first published in 1968, and it provided the source material for Ridley Scott's 1982 classic film Blade Runner. Indeed, film and book have become so closely associated that print and audio copies of the book are now published under the title Blade Runner: Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? But, as I discovered, they tell the same story very differently. Both are set in 1992, in a post-apocalyptic San Francisco. World War Terminus has choked the world's atmosphere with irradiated dust. Hoping to avoid genetic mutation, most surviving humans have been encouraged by the United Nations to emigrate to off-world colonies, such as that on Mars. As an incentive, each colonist is given a personal android servant. The androids are so well designed, they're virtually indistinguishable from humans.
In a giant, empty, decaying building, which had once housed thousands, a single TV set hawked its wares to an uninhabited room. Their ownerless ruin had, before World War Terminus, been tended and maintained. Here had been the suburbs of San Francisco, a short ride by monorail rapid transit. The entire peninsula had chattered like a bird tree with life and opinions and complaints. And now the watchful owners had either died or migrated to a colony world. Mostly the former. It had been a costly war, despite the valiant predictions of the Pentagon and its smug scientific vassal, the Rand Corporation, which had, in fact, existed not far from this spot. Like the apartment owners, the corporation had departed, evidently for good. No one missed it. In addition, no one today remembered why the war had come about, or who, if anyone, had won. The dust, which had contaminated most of the planet's surface, had originated in no country, and no one, even the wartime enemy, had planned on it. First, strangely, the owls had died. At the time, it had seemed almost funny. The fat, fluffy white birds lying here and there, in yards and on streets, coming out no earlier than twilight as they had while alive, the owls escaped notice. Medieval plagues had manifested themselves in a similar way, in the form of many dead rats. This plague, however, had descended from above. After the owls, of course, the other birds followed. But by then, the mystery had been grasped and understood. A meager colonization program had been underway before the war, but now that the sun had ceased to shine on Earth, the colonization entered an entirely new phase.
Few people remain on Earth. Some are unwilling to leave, and others unable. These include the specials, those judged genetically unfit, either physically or mentally, to be worth saving. Others, such as bounty hunter Rick Deckard, are there to keep Earth society running. He's employed by the San Francisco Police Department to eliminate, or retire, rogue androids. A group of the latest Nexus 6 model have killed their masters and returned to Earth. And when one of them shoots his boss, Deckard is tasked with hunting down and retiring the remainder of the group. Three of them, including their charismatic leader Roy, have found shelter with a special called J.R. Isidore, who has a menial job with a company that repairs synthetic animals. With most species extinct, owning a real live pet is a status symbol, but they cost a fortune. Most people make do with man-made copies that, like the Nexus 6, are virtually indistinguishable from the real thing. Rick Deckard owns an electric sheep, but plans to use the bounty money he'll earn to buy a real animal. As Deckard pursues his relentless task, the book explores deeper philosophical themes about what it is to be human. Empathy is the measure by which Deckard must test a subject to see whether they're human or android. The need to feel and demonstrate empathy lies behind the wish to own a real pet. It's also central to Mercerism, the new post-apocalyptic religion. Believers connect via virtual reality empathy boxes to suffer communally with their martyr-like saviour, Wilbur Mercer. In addition to religion, the book also examines the ethics around artificial intelligence and global corporations. And while 1992 may have come and gone without an apocalypse or the colonization of Mars, much of what Philip K. Dick flagged up in 1968 is very relevant today. Nowhere did I feel this more than in the use of profiling to determine how genetically worthwhile a human being is. As a special, J.R. Isidore is regarded as subhuman, inferior even to androids. Yet he, more than anyone, has natural empathy, which is the essential human quality. So, while Blade Runner retains the basic premise and many of the characters in the book that inspired it, if you read Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, hoping for the book of the film, you may well be disappointed. Many of the film's most iconic moments and lines were created by the screenwriters. Both film and book have plots that rattle along at a tremendous pace, keeping you guessing throughout. But the book focuses more on the morality of Deckard's task, and of a society that builds slaves in the image of perfect humans, while neglecting the imperfect humans in its midst. Philip K. Dick didn't live to see the film. He died a few weeks before its release, aged just 53. He did, however, read the script and preview a few scenes. His verdict? This indeed is not science fiction or fantasy. It is futurism. And I think that's true of both versions of the story. The version I downloaded from the RNIB library via OverDrive bears the new title, Blade Runner: Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? It's narrated by Jeff Harding and is TB23552. Now, back to Philip Reeve for the books of his life. So, was there a book that you read as a younger person that made you want to become a writer?
Yes, there were a whole bunch, really. I think from quite an early age I was very taken with books, and whatever I was reading made me want to write. So I was hugely influenced by C.S. Lewis, the Narnia books, when I was about 7 or 8, and then when I was about 9 or 10, Tolkien took over and The Lord of the Rings. Those were very important books to me because they sort of showed me that you could invent your own world to tell a story in, which is basically what I do for a living now. But I think a favourite author of mine, who I still go back to and read sometimes, is Rosemary Sutcliffe, who maybe isn't as well known nowadays as the other two are. Although she was a very big children's author at the time and is still highly regarded. She's very much the children's author that children's authors hold as a favourite. And Rosemary Sutcliffe wrote basically historical novels about sort of Roman and early medieval Britain, and usually from the point of view of a young person, generally a young man, setting out in life, having adventures.
Blood Feud by Rosemary Sutcliffe. Alexia always brings the candles a little too soon. Maybe she is afraid that I shall be trying to work without enough light to see by. Maybe she is afraid that in the dusk I shall start remembering and grow home-hungry. It is true that dusk is a good time for remembering, and of all times, a spring twilight is apt to turn the heart homeward. And I do remember so many things. Small, unimportant things. Gorse, honey-scented along the headlands, and the crash and cream of the long sea rollers beating on the jagged western coast. Curlew, crying over the high moors. The smell of a newborn calf brought in from the herd.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread on a sofa?
Yes, if I'm very bored or I can't sleep at night or I'm in hospital or something, what I tend to reach for is P.G. Wodehouse very often. The Jeeves and Worcester books are very light and just very beautifully written. And they're almost all exactly the same. In most of them, young Bertie Worcester has to, for some reason or other, go as an imposter into some rich aunt or uncle or relative's country house, and all kinds of farcical goings-on ensue. And he's guided through this process by his unflappable manservant, Jeeves. And the writing is just beautiful. Wodehouse was a master of English prose, and the characterization is good. The story is told by Bertie Worcester, who's this sort of upper-class 1920s twit, but a very engaging one and a surprisingly good storyteller. Strangely, we were talking earlier about my novel Railhead, which is a kind of a cyberpunky, futuristic thriller. And I had been reading, when I was writing that, I had been reading a lot of P.G. Wodehouse to my son, who, to my surprise, loved them when he was sort of 9 or 10. And I kind of realized halfway through Railhead that my hero was going in disguise aboard the Emperor's train, and that his unflappable robot companion was down in the servants' quarters giving him instructions. And I kind of realized I was basically rewriting P.G. Wodehouse. So not only is it my favorite curling up with on a rainy day book, it was strangely influential.
That's wonderful. I think that's rather a nice little exclusive for us.
Oh,
thank you very much.
Should I recommend a particular one, actually?
Yes, yeah. Please.
There are loads of Jeeves and Worcester books. My favourites are the short stories. I think they work very well in short story form. But of the novels, the best one is called The Code of the Worcesters, which is just a superb little... It's a comedy machine, basically. It's just perfectly structured, and everything works, and all the jokes pay off in the right places, and I would recommend it to anyone, I think.
Good evening, Jeeves.
Good morning, sir. This surprised me. Is it morning?
Yes, sir.
Are you sure? It seems very dark outside.
There is a fog, sir. If you will recollect, we are now in autumn, season of mists and mellow fruitfulness.
Season of what?
Mists, sir, and mellow fruitfulness.
Yes, yes, I see. Well, be that as it may, get me one of those braces of yours, will you?
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Yes, one of my favourite authors is Geraldine McCaughrean, who she wrote some very fine adult novels back in the 90s, but she's basically known as a children's writer, and a very, very fine one indeed. And I always go straight to her new books when they're published, and she's just released one called Where the World Ends, which is set in the 1700s, and it's about a boatload of boys from the island of St. Kilda who are taken out to live on a sea stack, this tiny little rocky island way offshore, out in the middle of the ocean somewhere, to collect birds and birds' eggs to get the St. Kildans through the winter. And this is a thing that happens every year, and they're left there for about a fortnight, and then the boat comes and picks them up. But on this particular year, the boat doesn't return, and they wait and they wait, and they end up having to spend the whole winter on this sea stack, and they don't know why the boat hasn't come back, they don't know what's happened. And it doesn't sound like much fun, you know, it sounds rather a bleak, grim sort of a book. But Geraldine McCaughrean is such a fine writer, and such a good and wise person, I think. She's just able to turn these things into the most wonderful story, and it is bleak and it is grim, and it's also funny and exciting and inspiring. It's a wonderful book.
Philip Reeve, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of reading with us and for being a guest on Read On Air.
Thank you.
And don't forget, if you'd like to share the books of your life, why not drop us a line via the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. So, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests, and to everyone who's been in touch about your book groups, the titles you've been enjoying, and your ideas for books that I should read. Read On Air will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, packed with book news, reviews, and author interviews. Simply go to audioboom.com and search for RNIB, where you'll find Read On Air and other great content from RNIB Connect Radio. So, until next week, thanks for listening, and remember to read on.